quite a few years ago, I wrote a letter to a disciple. I was going through some papers yesterday and I found it. And it has some interesting things in it. I thought maybe I would bring it along and read it to you today. Adherence to form and ritual cannot give you God realization. Neither will knowledge of the scriptures, the performing of asanas, nor the practice of pranayama take you to your goal. All of these things are but words which serve to bind the soul to the body, because the need for them is conceived only in the nebulous world of the mind. Man strives in many ways to seek and to become that which he already is in God. He uses many methods and follows many paths. He retires to a cave seeking to shut out the outer world, not realizing that the world is also God. He goes into the forest thinking to feel his oneness with all of nature, to see him manifesting in the birds, the animals, and in the beauty of every leaf and tree. He scales the height of a mountain, thinking that the nearer he reaches the summit, the greater will be his awareness of the sublimity of the Almighty. Having searched everywhere and done everything, he finally falls to his knees and prays, "Lord, I have tried every way I know to find thee, but thou art still hiding from me. My feet are bleeding and my spirit weary. I can do no more. Come to me, O my Lord, come to me. Reveal thyself, reveal thyself. I surrender my will to thee. Here, my Lord, take me." At that very moment of total surrender, when man knows that of himself he can do nothing, the Lord answers his prayer and reveals the blazing glory of his infinite presence. God realization is a thing of grace. It cannot be achieved through his own efforts. The existence of the world hinges on but one thought. When you sleep at night, the world ceases to exist. When you awaken in the morning, there it is. One thought. The whole universe is already contained within God. It always was, it is, and it always will be. So where is creation? Speaking for myself, this body is but the visible manifestation of that one who is eternal. It eats nothing, it wears nothing, it lives no place, and it goes nowhere. Conversely, it eats whatever is put before it, it wears whatever God directs, it lives wherever it happens to be, under conditions, whatever conditions it finds itself, and goes wherever he wills. In truth, there is no place but here, no time but now. We have never left the heart of God. Heaven is not a place but a state of consciousness. So also is hell. Man can live in whichever place he chooses by the mere acceptance or rejection of an idea which has been placed before him, because he becomes whatever his powerful mind accepts and puts into practice. My incomparable guru once said, "Only one who has attained the state of God realization can recognize it in another. When I put my foot upon the ground, I touch the whole earth and am therefore one with it." So it is with God realization. Having attained the realization of his oneness with God, man becomes one with the source of all knowledge, all wisdom, all power, all light, and all love. He is only to turn the tap on the fountain of truth, and the living waters of the Spirit rush forth to quench his thirst for knowledge and experience. In the infancy of his understanding, man knows that he knows not, but when he has had the full realization of his oneness with the Father, he knows and he knows that he knows, because he has become that. He can speak of it or not according to his own purpose, because he knows that the I within is all there is, and to that one all things are possible. It is because of this that it is not only possible, but it is the truth that such a one can have his attention fixed upon the infinite beloved inwardly, and at the same time be consciously aware of his presence in all of duality. He is at once the witness and the actor, the play and the one who conceived it. The fully God-realized soul enjoys this state, which is called Sahaja Samadhi, 24 hours a day, waking or sleeping. He is like the river that, having met the ocean, still continues to flow toward it. You will note in the simile, however, that even though he has become one with the ocean, still he remains the river at one and the same time. Even as the river is limited in its own boundaries, so too the waves of the ocean still touch the boundary of the sky and of the earth. And so it is through all of the workings of the manifestation of his oneness. Seemingly God limits himself when he takes human form, but man at all times is free. He is only to lay claim to the idea of freedom in his consciousness, because the idea of freedom or slavery is also a thing of the mind and is not the reality. The man who constantly dwells on the idea of escaping from the body, from the world, from the wheel of birth and rebirth, has not known nor understood God, because he has not come to the point of total surrender to his will. He does not know because he has not realized that God is all of life, that this play is God's very nature, part and parcel of himself, and that he, being eternal, continually explores and expresses the facets of his own one being. Man has had impressed upon his mind and accepted as truth the idea that he has come out from God and must therefore return to him. But where is he to go and to whom, if God is all there is? The human cannot be separated from the divine because God is both. We cannot deny that if, as we say, he is omnipresent, omniscient, and omnipotent. We cannot talk out of both sides of our mouth at one and the same time. That which I teach is called the practice of the presence of God. The technique is very simple. It is following the injunction of the Christ when he said, "The light of the body is the eye. Therefore, let thine eye be single, and thy whole body shall be filled with light." It is the practice of pranayama, or breath control, as taught in the Old Testament. It is the practice of keeping one's attention forever fixed upon him, and of giving to him in full surrender all that one is and all that one has. It is the practice of seeing him everywhere, in every man who stands before us, in every form that walks the earth, in the sun, the moon, and the stars, in the raindrop, and in the snowflake that falls, and in the soft wind that sweeps the earth and cools man's fevered brow. It is to meditate upon his beauty in all the things of nature, to herald his presence in the coming of the dawn and in the shadows of eventide. It is to take him into every facet of our existence, both waking and sleeping, because to sleep is also an act of rest. It is to practice kindness, consideration, and charity toward all, knowing that he is there. It is the practice of being perfect for his name's sake. It is the realization that love is a thing of the heart which cannot be cultivated by practice, because it is a gift of God, being his own nature, and therefore pours forth spontaneously, expressing the purity of his indwelling presence. It is practice of having faith in him, not in man, in horoscopes, astrology, stones which we wear on our bodies, psychic phenomena, palm reading, individual mantras, or the like. It is the knowledge that, being omnipotent, God alone has power. It is his, and he alone should use it. One who assumes that prerogative is a thief and a robber. It is all of these things, but most of all, it is the practice of realizing that we, being the separate cells of his one body, are already one with him. Such a practice is the highest art of meditation. It is constant and continuous thought of him, and it brings forth the ultimate in God realization in the shortest span of time. It is the power of positive thinking and the expressing of all that is good, beautiful, and wonderful in him. It is the replacing the idea that we are separated from God with a certain knowledge that we are one with him. It is learning to live in God and for God instead of dying for him, because he is eternal. He lives and he is all of life. There are two ways of doing away with the ego. One is to attempt to destroy it, and the other is to transform and transfigure it into the divine. The first road is dangerous and can result in insanity. The second is to seek first God and his kingdom, knowing that all of these things shall be added unto you. The first takes man one step at a time and explores only one place, that which in the dimness of his vision is the only one he can see, in the hope of reaching his goal. The path is treacherous because man is doing it himself. It takes forever because it is like going on a slow boat to China. It is no wonder that few ever reach it. The second one is safe because one's mind is always and forever fixed upon his goal. He hangs on only to the Lord, repeating his name constantly, knowing that he of himself can do nothing, and that he, being his child, is indeed an heir with Christ. As a man thinketh, so he is. My blessed master said, change yourself and you will change thousands. God alone is the guru, and it is he alone who functions in that capacity in the forms which he has chosen for that purpose. Man cannot function as his own guru. It is impossible. His very need for one is proof positive of his inability to function in that capacity. A starved body, the wearing of sackcloth and ashes, and a solemn and pious face are neither requisites for nor indications of God realization. In fact, they are an insult to that one who dwells within the body temple. The world will never change until we as individuals change, because the world is made up of individuals. It is only by putting forth from ourselves the power, the beauty, the wisdom, the light, and the love of God that the change will come to pass, and it will be in earth as it is in heaven. The Hindu scriptures say, abandoning all dharmas or actions, come unto me alone for shelter. This is what I teach. The realization of God is very simple. It is we who make it complex. I saw the results of what I teach in the changed lives of those who were before walking in darkness. I see them not only living God, but taking him into every facet of life, and through their example, changing the lives of others. Now let us speak briefly of food. This body subsisted on only glucose water for 4.5 months. It has lived for months on end with but one scant meal a day. It has taken only bread and milk at times, and fruit and nuts at others. It has also partaken of sumptuous meals and eaten gourmet food. It has lived in a rich man's mansion and in a humble cottage and all the places in between. It has slept on a mattress of eiderdown and on a bare wooden floor. It has slept on wooden bed and in a railway station where mosquitoes, cockroaches, and bedbugs as companions. It is done with a few hours of sleep night after night because its whole being was in the ecstasy of God. It has moved freely with all peoples of all nations, regardless of race, color, or creed. It has taken food from the soiled hands of a Muslim and others and found it good because it was given with love. It eats whatever food is put before it because, regardless of what it is, it knows that it is good because it comes from God. Let me quote from the Bible. And Jesus said, are ye also yet without understanding? Do not yet ye understand that whatsoever entereth in at the mouth goeth into the belly and is cast out into the draught? But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile the man. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands defileth not a man. And in the Hindu scriptures it says, the Brahmin with his scrolls and sanctities, the cow, the elephant, the unclean dog, the outcast, gorging dog's meat, are all one. Our Bible reading this morning is from St. Matthew chapter 6, beginning with verse 1. Take heed that ye do not your alms before men to be seen of them, otherwise ye have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth, that thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly. And when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly. But when ye pray, use not vain repetitions, as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. Be not ye therefore like unto them, for your Father knoweth what things ye have need of before you ask him. After this manner therefore pray ye, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. I want to speak to you this morning about the power of prayer. Prayer is tremendous. And Jesus has given us the method for meditation. I was thinking this morning as I was reading this Bible chapter that Jesus must have been the greatest yogi who ever lived, because the word yogi means union with God, and that he had that union with God, there can be no doubt at all. And he gave this method for meditation, and he tells you that you enter your secret closet and you close the door. What is the secret closet? It is the dwelling place of the Most High. It is God in you, your consciousness. I read in a place the other day where, in a book, this author said that God sat alone in the consciousness of himself, and he desired to create from himself. So he sent forth what is called the Word and clothed it in a garment of flesh. And the world came into being. So he said that the world was the only begotten Son of God, because through the thought of God, he put his spirit into every living thing and put a garment of flesh around it. And we have all sorts of things in every single kingdom that man knows of. But it is that consciousness which directs a bird to use his wings to fly, to make a nest, and to lay eggs, and to take care of his young. It is that consciousness which takes on the form of every single animal. It is that form, or that consciousness which takes on the form of a human being, which is his highest creation. And he himself dwells in the midst of us. Isn't that wonderful? When it says Jesus went up to the mountain to pray, it means that he went up into the secret closet of his own being. And he shut that door. In other words, he had to close out all of the thoughts that the senses are constantly bringing into manifestation in our consciousness. You have to get rid of all the thoughts in your mind and focus your attention fully upon God. So we are given a few simple techniques. The spiritual eye technique, the Hong Saw technique, where you watch yourself breathing. You do not control your breath, you merely watch the fact that you are breathing. We have the wonderful Kriya, which is the revolving of the life force around the spine and through the brain. These few simple techniques we are given. And to repeat the name of God constantly, keeping our attention upon him. And repeating his name enables us to do that. This prayer that he gave me is so wonderful, I think. Lord, let my attention be forever fixed upon thee. Let me love thee. Let me serve thee. Let me worship thee alone. Thou art all and all in all. And that is so true. We must keep our attention forever fixed upon him. And especially when we sit down to meditate, just let go of all the worries and the cares of the day. And know that God is in the midst of you. And that if you will go up into the mountain of your own being, into that higher consciousness, the secret place of the Most High, the Almighty God, that he will commune with you, that he will speak to you through your intuition and the thoughts that come into your mind. It's wonderful, it's beautiful to commune with God. If I had not practiced this through all of this past year, I would not be here now. I have kept so close to him. He is ever within me. He is constantly speaking to me, and I am listening to him. I used to get things from God, you know, when my husband was still alive, and I would tell him something that I'd gotten, and he'd say, "Well, where did you get that?" And I would say, "Well, God told me." So he scolded me one day. "What is this God told you? That's ridiculous." I said, "Well, he does. Do you want me to take credit for it myself? I can't do that." Because the thought came to me, the knowledge that this was the truth came to me. He gave it to me in thought form. And as I think about it, as I concentrate upon it, and I look at the Bible and see the verification of what he has given me in this Bible, I said, I cannot help but know that it is truth. So God spoke to me. He gave it to me. I am nothing. I don't know any of these things. I'm not educated. I have no schooling. So I have to rely on him completely. I think I've told you about the time when I decided I didn't have enough knowledge of English to continue on as a minister, and I thought I'd better somehow get myself in the university. I didn't know how because I didn't have a high school diploma, but I called the university and found out what was necessary. And after I did that, I felt sort of strange, and I sat down and I started to meditate. And I meditated very deeply because I asked God, what is this feeling I have? I know that I need more education in order to do your work, and yet I feel strange about going to the university. What is the trouble? And then all of a sudden, I said, what is your will for me? And he laid it right back in my own lap. He said, your will is my will. I have the decision to make. But he also made one further statement. Isn't it true that whenever you had a need to know anything, whenever you've had any need, have I not supplied it? And I thought back over the years when I started out as a minister, not having any training with the master personally, no education. And believe me, it was not an easy thing to do. And I thought how, in spite of all of the things that I lacked, that somehow he had managed to use this body, this mind, which he himself alone had formed, and to use it to his purpose and for his advantage, hopefully. So I gave up the idea of going to the university. And I carried on. And now every time I come before you, as a rule, I am totally unprepared. I have a Bible passage. Maybe I have something to read to you. Maybe a story in mind. And that's about it. I have a subject which he gives me. And from that subject, which sometimes I get from the heading of a chapter of a book, or maybe it just comes to me through something that happens. And I stand before you and I have to turn the whole thing over to him because what do I know? What do I know? I have no strength, I have no knowledge, I have no anything but what the Lord gives me. And it is so beautiful. I want to talk to you about the power of prayer because that power is so tremendous, so great. And we find demonstrations of it where people in their need finally kneel down and pray to God. They have a desire in their minds and in their hearts. Maybe it is for health, maybe it is for supply of some sort. Maybe it is that someone whom they love is in trouble, but they have a desire for something more perfect than what they have been able to manifest. So when, in order to fulfill that desire, they pray, but the rules that Christ laid down are very, very clear. You enter into your secret closet, or in other words, you withdraw your attention from all the things in the outer world, from the things of your senses. You close the door on them and you meditate deeply. You pray unceasingly. A little story came to mind that I had read recently in the book called Medjib, which is an account of Master's life written by his brother. And it's a beautiful little story. Master, right from the beginning of his existence, wanted God with all of his heart. And even when he was just a tiny fellow, hardly able to fold his knees, still he sat in the half lotus posture in meditation on the sands and meditated upon God. He talked to him all the time. But this story told about the fact that when he was growing up, he had just entered school and he was learning to read and write, that his father and mother used to receive letters every day, and his elder brother Ananta also received letters from people that he'd known in college and different friends that he'd made around. And Medja, as he was called, which means the second elder brother, stood there with no letters at all. And he was feeling very sorry about that, but he never had any letters. And he used to ask his father and mother, after they read the letters, who they were from and what they said. And his brother Ananta used to tease him. He said, you see, Mukunda, you have no letters at all. He was rather cruel to him. He said, nobody writes to you, but I have many friends and they write to me. You will have to wait till you grow up before you can receive letters. And Mukunda was very, very hurt about all of this. So he started to pray to God. Every day he would go to his attic room and he would pray to God to send him some letters, but none ever came. Finally, one day he decided to write to God himself and tell him about the way he felt about it. So he wrote a letter to God's lotus feet. And he told him that his mother and his father and his brother received letters all the time, but he never received a letter. And he said, "Will you not write me a letter?" And he went on and told all the things he felt. He said, "I speak to you every day, but still I don't hear from you at all. You must write to me. Please do write to me." And then he said, "What else can I say? Mother and father are well." And then he said, bowed. Mukunda. He bowed to God as he was writing the letter. So he put the letter in an envelope and he took it to the post office and mailed it. He didn't know it, you see, but the clerks, when they saw it, thought that it had come from somebody who was mentally deranged, and they just threw it out. So time passed and day after day went by, and still he received no letter from God. And he was just terribly hurt. He didn't know what to do. And so finally he sat down and he said to God, "God, are you so busy running the world that you cannot take time to write a letter to me? Are you ill?" All of this from this little child's mind, just because he wanted a letter so badly. He said, "Please write me a letter. I do talk to you every night or every day, and I pray to you, but you do not answer me at all. You must answer me. I am your child. You must answer me." And so he went on. He stopped writing letters. He stopped doing some of the things he'd been doing, but every day he continued to pray that he would get a letter. He never gave up. That is the secret of powerful prayer. You never give up praying until you reach your objective, until your prayer is made manifest. So as he was praying one night in his attic room, all of a sudden the whole room was filled with a great light. And God answered his prayer by coming to him through this light and answered everything that his heart desired. So he called his mother and she came, and she was very joyful, and she said, "Mukunda, I knew that surely God must answer your prayer. Anyone who is as great a devotee as you and who prayed so constantly to him must have an answer to his prayer." And so this is the way that God answered Mukunda and wrote him a letter through the light of his own being that flooded the room in which he sat and meditated on him. How beautiful a story that is. And how wondrously it tells about the love and the devotion of this great God-man, even from the time he was a very tiny child. He was born to conquer the little self. He was born to be a great spiritual engine, to lead thousands and thousands and thousands of people to God. And so he did. Would that each and every one of us had such love for God as that man, that we would give everything that we have, everything that we are, in search of God. And having found him, then we might spread the truth, we might spread his word, and see the change manifesting in the world. Certainly it needs it, as it never has before. But gradually we are forming, one by one, and one by one, and one brings someone else, and someone else brings someone else. And so we gather a solid group, all meditating upon God, all but with one idea in mind. Lord, reveal thyself, reveal thyself. Make me one with thee. Give me my God realization. Give it to me. And yet it does not come as a gift. It comes through your own effort, the intensity of your own prayer. If you let every prayer go for everything else and just pray for the realization of your oneness with him, surely he will appear to you. I remember so well when I came to that state, and I wanted him so badly that tears flowed down my cheeks. I cried and cried and cried. I sobbed for him, and then it was that some of the pre-crucifixion experiences started to happen, and I was lifted up and I was given some tremendous visions even in those days. And then when I went to India, the one thing that I knew that was required of me was that I threw all of my attachments into the ocean and came to God with only my desire for oneness with Him. And how wonderfully, how fearfully He answered my prayer. It was not an easy experience, certainly. I was with some people the other evening listening to a tape that had been made back in 1968 about some of the experiences that I went through. And on that tape was the voice of a man who had been at the ashram when I went through this crucifixion experience, and he'd been hunting for me all day. And finally he had found me at the Oceanic Hotel. And his voice is on the tape saying that because of what he had seen me go through, that he had joined SRF. And so he had heard about the changes that were made, and he had come to ask me about them. Well, I was giving a talk to a large group of Papa's devotees that night, and I couldn't give him a private interview, so I asked him to come in, and they sat right in the front row, and they asked me some questions. I think maybe you heard something on that tape on New Year's Eve. And he was asking me questions, and I thought, well, I won't lie, I'll just tell it the way it is. So I did. But it was an amazing thing, the way that everything works out. And so having given up everything that I called my own, I came out with everything, the knowledge, the realization of my oneness with God. And no matter what trials, what tribulations I've had to go through since, always, God is with me. He is constantly in my consciousness. He walks with me, talks with me. He makes me know that He is forever present in me. He guides, He directs me in all things that I do. I've had some very, very difficult situations to deal with this past year, and if I hadn't given them to God all the way, I don't know how I would be standing in front of you talking to you at this moment. But prayer, communion with God, brings me through, because whatever comes to me in the way of an experience that I have to handle, I go in and ask Him. I go inside into that secret closet and I close the door and I concentrate upon Him and I ask Him, which way shall I go? What shall I do in order that it will happen the best for all concerned? And I remember constantly the prayer that Master wrote to me one time, and he said, Beloved indwelling presence, my part of God, you see to it for me that this problem is taken care of in complete harmony, wisdom, and justice for the highest good of all concerned. Now that prayer harms no single person, yet it gives everything into God's hands. And it asks for perfection, that the problem may be taken care of in complete harmony, wisdom, and justice for the highest good of all concerned. And this is the way I operate every day of my life, through prayer. I am always reaching for the rainbow, the day when all of the clouds will disappear, when I can sit quietly and at peace, commune with Him, speak to all of you, teach you. How wonderful it would be, I think sometimes to myself, if I could be like Papa was, sitting in a nice, quiet, easy chair with a beautiful cushion underneath me and all the people gathered at my feet, and I could just speak of God for hours as He did, or read to you out of spiritual books as He did, and have the joy of our communion, our gathering together under one roof. How wonderful it would be. But God has kept me so busy and coping with so many things so far that that hasn't been possible. But I still look forward to that day, that it will be my dream come true, and probably yours too, because you always want to be with me and I want to be with you. But maybe one day God will arrange it. So now I go through whatever God has given to me for the moment in full faith and trust and knowledge that one day the clouds will all disappear and that the sun will come through, that everything will be as it should be in Him, and that I can complete the work that He has given me the vision of, and that I can bring forth the wonder, the beauty, the truth, and the glory of His presence in every part of space. How wonderful that will be. Prayer is answered, believe me, I know. There are many who call upon God in this form when they are in difficulty. I remember one time, I may have told you about this before, but it does bear repeating. It was around the Christmas season, and I was sitting wrapping packages, and I had someone with me, and I was in great pain. I was suffering inwardly, and this person said to me all of a sudden, they were startled and frightened. They said, "You have the death mask on your face." And I went into the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and I saw it myself. There it was. And I seemed to be having chest pains. I didn't find out until 1 week later that Bonnie's daughter, Becky, had been almost asphyxiated, that she had wakened in the morning and her husband had gone to college. And they had had a fire in the fireplace the night before. And Peter, before he left in the morning, had closed the draft, and so all the fumes had come out. And so when she went to get up, she fell unconscious on the floor, and she tried to pick herself up, and she would crawl a little ways and get up, and then she would fall again. And she kept this up, and finally she made it to the door, but she didn't have the strength to reach up and open the door. So all of a sudden she said, concentrating on me because she has tremendous faith and love for God in my form, "God, Christ, Guru." And she found within herself at that very moment the strength to reach up and open the door. Let in the air, she took a deep breath, and she crawled out on the porch, and she fell again. But as she kept coming back into consciousness, she kept crawling, and she crawled until she lay unconscious in the middle of the street. A motorist came along, saw her there, picked her up, and took her to the hospital, which just happened to be cut a corner from where she lived. And they took her into emergency. They didn't know what had happened to her, so they worked on her, trying to bring her back to consciousness, and finally did to some degree, so that they could ask her or they could call her husband. And she told him, and they called him, and he immediately sensed what had happened, stopped by the house and verified his suspicion, went over and told him what had happened. So he finally took her home. She was healed. She was cured. Her life was saved. Through what? Through total faith, because faith, whatsoever ye pray for, believing that you receive it, ye shall have. Believing. That great platform, that great foundation of faith. Faith in God and the Guru. How many times I have used that myself when I needed help with my own Guru, and he was in Los Angeles and I was in Seattle. But my faith in the power of God in him was so complete that distance didn't make any difference, nor did it with her. So anyway, she was all right. But for 1 week after all of this happened, I had something she didn't have to work out, because I brought up mucus from my lungs and it was all colored with smoke. It was very, very interesting, and yet I had known nothing about it. And this same girl, whose faith is so strong and who writes me such beautiful God letters, had another experience. I may have told you this too, but I'll repeat it. Peter had a dog by the name of Harley. And Harley was quite a dog. And he was, he'd run out and run every place and make himself known. So one day she was walking up in the woods with him. She was visiting her grandmother's farm. And Harley ran ahead, and a big truck came along with tires on it about that wide. And Harley ran right in front of the truck, and the truck ran over in both the front and the back wheels. By all accounts, he should have been nothing more nor less than a fur rug on the floor. And that dog got up and walked away from that accident, because again, this girl with full faith called God, Christ, Guru. And she knew that the dog would be saved. It was the faith in God, in the Guru, that brought this tremendous change, this tremendous miracle into being. So she took the dog to the veterinary afterward, and they couldn't even find a scratch on him. Now that is a real miracle, believe me. So we were meeting in another apartment, not in the one that I have lived in recently, but in another one. And so Peter decided we were going to have a meeting that night, that the dog should come and visit his guru. I also have a dog as a disciple. So I told him that dogs weren't permitted. Well, he would sit with them on the lanai, he said, and then Harley would be quiet. Well, that was all well and good to say, but he got on the lanai. And I had had a very strange experience the night before. I had spent the day with a man who had been a German soldier in the Second World War. And he'd been in the midst of battle, and I don't know what all had happened, but somehow an entity had attached itself to him. And when I hugged him that night, when he left from the interview, as I hugged everybody, apparently it attached itself to me. And I didn't know about it. I'd never had an experience with anything like that before. I went into the bedroom to get ready to go to bed, and I reached over on my nightstand to pick up a book and dropped it on the floor, and just then this ectoplasm just enveloped me all around me, and I just had to fight it with everything I had. It was trying to get in and take over my body. It was just like a yellow sulfurous haze that came in as smoke, and I spit it out. I did everything I could, and I fought it literally with my hands. Finally, it was dispelled. Well, it was a little frightening, as you can imagine. So after I got myself together for a moment, I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror. Both my eyeballs were burned, and to this day the left eye suffers from that. I had a blister on my nose. The inside of my mouth was burned, and I was all with a red burn across my chest. So I came out, and one of my students was living on another floor in the same apartment building, and I thought, well, I'll call her and have her come up and sleep with me, because I was really frightened. And I thought about that a little while, and I thought, no, this is a test that God has given me. Everything is God. I will go to bed and sleep. But just before I did, I had heard that spirits didn't like incense. So I went into the living room and I got the incense burner and a leather pad to put it on so it wouldn't burn my dressing table. Came back, lit the incense. It was one of the long stick ones. I went into the bathroom again for a moment. When I came out, the incense was totally gone. And I thought, well, that's strange that it should have burned down so rapidly and not even a sign of anything left. But I thought, oh, well, it's another one of those things. I'm just going to bed and go to sleep. And this I did. I slept well. I woke up in the morning and remembered the incident of the night before, so I went to get the incense off of it, off of the leather pad, and there was a deep hole burned in the leather pad. And I raised the leather pad, and that incense had burned a hole right through the dresser. And David and Albie can testify to this, because I think it was a year and a half ago, they repainted my whole bedroom set, and that scar, which testified on the wood to what the truth of what I say, was still there. They had to sand it down. They did a beautiful job, for which I am very, very grateful. But here was the living evidence of the struggle that I had been through. And it remained with me for quite a few years, and I thought about it every now and then, but that particular experience never reoccurred. But to go back to Harley, apparently this entity was still around. I had gotten rid of him from around me, but he was still in the apartment. And so Harley was sitting on Peter's lap. All of a sudden he looked between the statue of St. Francis, which I have, and an end table, and he just growled with everything he had, and he made one dive for it. And so it was a little bit startling. Well, we finally got rid of it. We prayed, we meditated. I didn't tell anybody what had happened. And we prayed and we meditated that night and then for succeeding nights. And finally, it all disappeared and went away. But Peter had to take Harley down and put him in the van so he wouldn't get me thrown out of the apartment house at that time. All of these experiences I share with you for but one reason, to show you that when your faith in God is great enough, God answers the prayers. Becky had that faith and her life was saved. She had that faith and the life of her dog, or Peter's dog, was saved. It is having complete and absolute faith that God is your Father and that He will take care of every need that you have. So when you pray, pray believing. And Jesus is very explicit that He doesn't just want you to repeat, as sometimes in the Orthodox churches we were taught to repeat, the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." And it was said so rapidly that you didn't finish the prayer before another one was started and one was imposing itself on the other. He said, that's the way the heathens pray. Don't do that. Pray to God with full concentration. But make your prayer be for Him first. last and always and in between, because having him, then you have tapped, as I have said in this letter that I wrote to the disciple, the fountainhead of all knowledge, of all truth, of all supply, and everything will come to you. Believe me, I know this is true because my whole life has been lived this way. I lived in abject poverty for years, wondering where I was going to get food to put on the table for my little ones and for my family. But somehow God always supplied. He supplied me with money. I would sometimes give away the last piece of money I had, whether it was a dime or a quarter, and the next day I would get two or three times as much money as I had given away. And this is the way my life has gone always. As ye give, so shall ye receive. And it is in truth, the truth. And don't forget that applies to every facet of your life. As you go about, think of harmony, harmony. Give the love of God to everyone you meet. Norman Vincent Peale was talking to someone one day, and this individual said that he had wakened one morning and it was blustery and cold out, and he hated to go out into that cold, but as he had to go to work, he had to go out, so he bundled himself out and he went out, and his neighbor was in the yard, next yard, shoveling snow, and he said to him, it's a wonderful day, isn't it? And the neighbor said, yes, it is. So he kept on walking, and he finally got on the bus and got himself to work. And somehow that one phrase had set the story for the whole day. So with everyone he met, he said, it's a great day out, isn't it? Everybody's face lit up, and their steps quickened a little bit, and they walked a little bit faster with a little more spring in their step. And yes, it was a good day. So when he came home that night, he told his wife, he said, you know, your day is what you make it. If you look for happiness, if you know that everything that is about you now is for your highest good and that it's a great day, and you put that forth to everybody you meet, he said it will change your whole life. And this is the truth. Your attitude about life, your prayer to God to give you everything that you need for each day, that you may live it completely and fully in the love of him and in service to him, is tremendous. Norman Vincent Peale was a wonderful man, and his idea of the power of positive thinking was a great, great thing and a great book that he wrote. I had the privilege of attending his church one time when I was in New York, I think it was, and it was indeed a privilege to listen to him speak, but constantly he told about his experiences with the various people who were members of his congregation. And he told about one man who had been an alcoholic. And he said the man had been dried out. He had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and had been dried out, as the expression goes. But one afternoon he was sitting in his study working, and this man's presence came to him so strongly. And he had a very, very deep feeling that the man was in trouble. So immediately he sat there, forgot his work, and prayed for the man with everything that he had. Well, he didn't know why he had done this or what had happened to the man. And he didn't see the man again for 2 or 3 weeks. But the man came into his office and he sat down. He said to him, well, I am still dry. But he said, I had a peculiar experience, he said, a few days ago or whenever it was. He said, I even went right up to the bar and started to order a drink. And he said, all of a sudden, something stopped me. So Reverend Peale said, was it at 4 o'clock on such a day? And the man looked astounded. He said, yes, how did you know? So he said, well, I felt you, and I sat still and prayed for you. He said, well, I pushed myself away from the bar, and I went out and bought a box of chocolates, and I ate every one of them. And that kept me from drinking. I must remember that. I love chocolate too. But anyway, do you see the power of prayer? Many times I've had that same thing happen to me when all of a sudden some one person in the congregation impinges themselves upon my consciousness and I feel them so definitely. Maybe they're in pain or something, and I feel the pain exactly where it is. So I sit and I pray for them. And then later I find out that in truth they were in difficulty, and that they were praying to me, to God in this form, perhaps for help at that time. You see, it is said that when a person has realized their oneness with God, that there is a spiritual ambulance, they call it, that ambulance that forms itself around the body and is to the farthest corners of the earth. Whoever calls on God in that form, that spiritual force activates itself and goes out and takes care of it. It is the faith of the individual praying that makes them whole, that brings the healing about. It is your faith which is the foundation of everything, the faith that your prayers are being answered by God. It is tremendous. I have been so ill at times that I could scarcely get my body off the chair or off the bed. And I have prayed to God in my guru. I have maybe sent him a telegram at times, or wrote him a letter and got a telegram back. But the minute he received it, the change in my body was absolutely fantastic. It was as though somebody had come and just did a house cleaning all through my body, and there I was, all filled with energy and vigor again and feeling perfectly normal. Many times this last year I wish he was still in the body. I commune with him in the spirit constantly. But it'd be awfully nice to be able to send him a telegram or a letter, or to call him on the telephone. And one time I remember that Sister Dia and I were talking, and she said to me, "You know, Mildred, there's one thing I've never understood." She said, "You used to write and telegraph Master when you were in need, but," she said, "you never telephoned him once. Why didn't you telephone him?" I said, "Well, I always felt that he had so much on his hands to take care of it. He was so busy that I didn't want to bother him. So I said I just sent him a letter or a telegram. But I said always I got my help, so that was all that was necessary. Because my faith in God, in my guru, was so great that nothing could have shaken it. And that is still true this day and will always be true." I had an interesting conversation with a man the other evening. And he said, "When you come back next time, when you're reincarnated, what animal form would you like to come back in?" I looked at him in utter amazement. I said, "I don't want to come back in the form of an animal. I want to come back as a human being. I like being a human being. I like being a woman." I said, "I want to continue serving in a human form, preferably that of a woman." And so he raised his eyebrows. Thought that was rather strange, but it is true. Why would I want to come back in the form of an animal? Because you're limited. Man alone has the consciousness to do so many things, and above all, to find that in truth he is God in human form. That the consciousness which is in your form, which is in my form, is God within us, and it has taken on a garment of flesh. So if we will just close our eyes and go deep within that secret closet, close the doors of the senses, and concentrate totally upon him, asking him to reveal himself, asking him for the answer to anything. But don't forget, because he is that life within you, that intelligence within you, that he walks with you, he talks with you, he knows every single problem you have before you even voice it to him. He is quite aware of it, and he has taken care of it. He is nearer than anything else you can possibly imagine. He is the I am in you, that conscious knowledge of the fact that you exist, that you are alive. That is the Christ in you, the Christ in you. How beautiful, how wonderful that thought is. We have been shown pictures of the Christ drawn by many, many artists. I remember one time when I was out to my daughter's house, and she had a picture of Master up on the mantle, and she had a very close friend who was who belonged to the Assembly of God and was married to a pastor of the Assembly. And we got to talking about the picture, and I said how Christ-like his face is, which it is. It's just beautifully Christ-like. These great shining eyes that follow you no matter where you go in the room when you see that picture. And she said, "Well, I prefer the pattern of my own Christ," or the picture of my own Christ, I should say. And I said, "Which one?" She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I've seen many pictures of the Christ." I said, "But they have all been drawn by artists And I said, that is their personal conception of what Christ looks like. I said, have any of them actually seen him? Have you? So I tell you that I saw Christ in this man, and this is the picture of the Christ whom I follow, because he taught me more about the Christ in one evening than I had learned all the rest of my life in an Orthodox church. He put Christ inside of me. He made me know that he was my life, my intelligence, my instant help in every single need, that I was surrounded by his light. And I felt all warm and wrapped in a warm blanket of the love of Christ. And I have been ever since. It's a beautiful way to think of Christ, a beautiful way to know that he is inside of you, that nothing can separate you. And if ever you feel anybody that is antagonistic towards you, if you will just visualize that yellow Christ light, an aura of Christ light surrounding your whole body, know that no evil or lower force can penetrate it to harm or influence you, then all that which is not good that wants to get in is burned up in that great fire of that light of Christ. But yet it does not keep your good from coming to you, so that always you are in communion with him. So he walks with you, talks with you, and gradually you come to know, as that old song goes, that you are his own. The power of prayer is the greatest power on earth. Use it. You have been given the tools for going within your secret closet and meditating upon him. And as it says in the Old Testament, I shall guide and direct thee with mine eye. So again, they're speaking of the spiritual eye in the center of the forehead, the Christ center. And if you will concentrate your total attention upon there, look for that eye, for that light within your own being, gradually that eye will come into manifestation and you will see visions. And if you will listen to the sound, the word of God in your right ear, you will hear his direction, and work that with your feeling, which is your intuitive force. And that is John the Baptist within you, who comes to baptize you with the Spirit in the beginning. He shows you intuitively what the beginning of going to God and being one with him means. John the Baptist, he baptizes, but as he himself said, that he is not worthy to tie the latchets of the one who will come after him, the Christ. Because as you practice this intuitive, listening to this intuitive faculty, gradually it develops. And then one day God lifts you up and puts you through the experience, which makes you know that you may find the Christ within you. And from that moment forward, he lives in you, he speaks in you, he sees in you, he hears through your ears. Every single thing is nothing but the Christ. And you know that he is universal in every atom of space, in every single form that exists. That is the first and only begotten Son of God. That one which came from him, manifested itself and became everything in the world. But God himself, in the form of consciousness, sits and directs every single thought, word, and action.